Good morning, I'm James Holloway here for Appellant Community Alternatives Virginia. This appeal relates to limitations on DMAS's ability to retract Medicaid payment from healthcare providers. The issue of retraction is governed by common law principles of contract. In 2009, this court, in the Psychiatric Solutions case, applied common law principles of contract and also applied the default rule of material breach, which says a provider is entitled to payment unless the noncompliance amounts to a material breach of the participation agreement. So in 2009, that was the only case authority from this court regarding Medicaid payment retraction. There's a very significant timing issue here, and that is, when was the participation agreement signed? The participation agreement was signed in February of 2011. As of that point in time, Psychiatric Solutions was the only authority on Medicaid payment retraction.
Counsel, I hate to stop you so early in your argument, but let me just bring up a point in reference to whether this is procedurally barred, because this was not an issue that was raised to the circuit court was not raised to DMAS. Is that correct?
I don't agree, Your Honor. We've been arguing all along that this Culpepper case, which I'm going to get to in a minute.
Well, but by the Culpepper case, you argue the Culpepper case, but not specifically in terms of any displacement or retroactivity.
Well, Your Honor, we argued that the Culpepper does not apply because we did not waive our right to rely on the material breach principle.
But how specific do you need to be in your estimation for it to be preserved? I guess that's part of the question that we have to answer, right, and that's before us.
It was specifically preserved. There are no magic words that have to be used. And the whole principle of waiver is there has to be a known relinquishment of a right. We clearly said repeatedly at every level that material breach applied, that we did not agree to waive material breach. And so we have been asserting this principle from day one. Now, again, I don't see any particular words that had to be used, but there was never a relinquishment of any right. We've been saying material breach and Culpepper does not apply from the beginning of the case.
I guess the specific question, though, is saying that the material breach as referenced in Culpepper enough to get us to sort of the displacement theory, that's something that you also argue.
Our position is we have argued all along that we never agreed to displace material breach, and we have been saying all along that that's the case. Well, that we had to use material breach, and they did not.
When you signed the agreement under what was our case? First Stop. When you signed the agreement, didn't you agree to a standard other than material breach? Isn't that our holding?
We did not. First of all, I don't think that's the holding from First Stop. I think that principle about displacing material breach, that was first announced in the Culpepper case in 2015. In 2011, when my client signed the participation agreement, they agreed to, and this is according to DMAS, the reason why there's supposedly an agreement to displace material breach is because my client agreed to comply with applicable law and DMAS policies. Now, as of February 2011, when we signed that agreement, the applicable law was Psychiatric Solutions. That was it.
I'm sorry. Again, First Stop at Culpepper. It's Culpepper I was referring to. In Culpepper, we held that the agreement itself created a standard other than material breach. Would that be a fair reading?
Your Honor, I'd perhaps say it slightly differently. The Culpepper court said in that particular case the parties had agreed to displace the principle of material breach.
That was the same agreement that you signed, wasn't it?
It was, Your Honor.
Then why didn't, at that time, you agree to a standard other than material breach?
Well, one other interesting thing is, in the Psychiatric Solutions case, the contract also had the same exact language. And this court, looking at the same exact language that we have in this case, did not find any agreement to displace material breach. So I don't know how we got to this point, because this court, Psychiatric Solutions, 2009, found nothing about displacing material breach.
Well,
in fact,
the issue really didn't come up in Psychiatric Solutions. They found there was a material breach, but nowhere in the Psychiatric Solutions say, and oh, by the way, that's the only standard we need to apply.
It didn't come up, and I find that actually to be significant, because that means the court did not, on its own, see any agreement to displace. And DMAS itself was not asserting
but
in that
our
case.
But court doesn't raise substantive issues. Or we can obviously raise jurisdictional issues. So how is that supportive of your position, simply because that wasn't announced in the psychiatric solutions case?
First of all, I agree that the psychiatric solutions court did not talk about displacement. But I find it significant that DMAS at that point also was not arguing that there was a displacement material breach. Both parties were treating this as a material breach case. And that was the authority that was in place and the only authority when we signed the agreement in 2011. Now, Culpepper does come out in 2015, and it says that they found an agreement to displace material breach. But the significant thing for me is the timing here. When my client signed the agreement in February of 2011, my client agreed to comply with applicable law. Applicable law in February of 2011 was Psychiatric Solutions, which said a provider is entitled to payment unless its noncompliance amounts to a material breach. So that was the law, applicable law.
What is the case that holds there must be a material breach?
I would argue that's Psychiatric Solutions, Your Honor.
But Psychiatric Solutions just says there was a material. We decide cases on the best and narrowest grounds. And the narrowest grounds in Psychiatric Solution was to decide the issue of whether there was a material breach or not, not to expand and say, oh, by the way, the agreement doesn't require that.
The Psychiatric Solutions Court specifically held a provider is entitled to payment. I'm almost quoting this. Provider is entitled to payment unless its noncompliance is a material breach of the participation agreement. It said we're entitled to payment unless there's a material breach. So the court has previously put material breach in play. That was the standard. And again, if you take the state's theory, the state's theory is, and this actually even comes out of Culpepper, Culpepper acknowledges, yes, material breach is the default rule unless there is an agreement to displace. And the Culpeper Court cites to the Supreme Court's Cranford decision. So actually, the whole genesis of this argument goes back to Cranford. If you look at Cranford, the Supreme Court said these default rules are important and they're going to apply unless there's a clearly manifested agreement to displace the default rule. And so our whole point here is there was no clearly manifested agreement to displace material breach.
How is the argument that there is not a clear displacement in terms of the contract when there is the agreement to abide by the federal and state rule or law as well as the DMAS rules and regulations? And part of the DMAS requirements were in terms of very specific keeping and presentation of documentation records.
That clause in the participation agreement, definitely part of it is you have to comply with DMAS policies. But another part of that clause, and if you're using standard principles of contract interpretation, you have to look at all the language. The contract says we also agreed to comply with applicable law, which included the principle announced in Psychiatric Solutions.
Counsel, before Judge Petty asks his question, I just want to tell you you're into your rebuttal time. You can certainly go forward, and I'll allow Judge Petty, obviously, to answer his question.
Well, just quickly. We have to, the inter-panel accord doctrine requires that, whether we agree with it or not, a panel must follow a precedent enunciated by a previous panel. If you're correct that Psychiatric Solutions requires material breach, then it would seem to me that Culpeper Regional would be inconsistent with our inter-panel accord doctrine because it doesn't follow the holding of Psychiatric Solutions. And my question is, how can that be?
Well, Your Honor, I would say, and my interpretation of Culpepper is that it was saying in that particular case, the parties had agreed to displace material breach. Now, one other point that's very important to make here is the Ablix case, which came out after Culpepper. The Ablix case had the same exact contract language we have here, and Ablix, post-Culpepper, still applied the doctrine of material breach. So I don't interpret the case law as saying there's some grand proposition here, especially with the Morrison case. You have to look at each particular case and the circumstances of that case. Have the parties agreed to displace material breach? So I think it's possible for the court here to issue a narrower ruling that in this particular case, under these circumstances, the parties did not agree to displace material breach.
What was that case you mentioned?
Ablix.
Ablix?
think it's DeMass versus Ablix. That was in 2005, and a fascinating case because that came out shortly after Culpepper. It cited the Culpepper, and yet the court there still applied a material breach analysis. So I can't interpret Culpepper as a grand...
Ablix stands for the proposition that material breach is the default position.
Yes, and they applied it in that case, and that was a post-Culpepper case.
And then because if you there's nothing in Ablix that says there's displacement.
Right.
There's nothing in that Ablix case that specifies displacement.
Correct.
So you fall back to default, which is the definition of default.
Right. And again, the significance of timing here is critical. Ablix was after the Culpepper case. And actually, Morrison came after Culpepper. And Morrison said you have to look at each individual case to figure out if there was an agreement to displace. So I would argue Culpepper can stand on its facts.
Wait. Ablix was an unpublished opinion.
Yes.
Was it not? And unpublished opinions have no precedential value for this court.
I agree. Not binding, but is hopefully informative.
So if Ablix is inconsistent with our previous published case, we have to follow the published opinion.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue they're not inconsistent. I think each case was looking at, was there an agreement in that particular case to displace material breach? And even if you go back to Culpepper, in turn, you have to go back to Cranford. Cranford said you have to have a clearly manifested agreement to displace. And I do not see that here. All we've done is sign this form agreement, agreeing to comply with applicable law and DMAS policies. Applicable law was Psychiatric Solutions when we signed that agreement. The Culpepper principle wasn't even around in February of 2011 when we signed that agreement. How could we have agreed to accept that case that came out almost 4 years later? I know I'm supposed to reserve some time, so I'll just pause here. Thank you.
Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Abrar Azamuddin, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Department of Medical Assistance Services.
Counsel, I'm going to jump right in. I did it to him, I'm going to try to be equal about this. The issue about the procedural default, what the appellant is essentially arguing, these are the arguments he put forth before DMAS, and where they're arguing Culpepper preserves any type of arguments of displacement. Why wouldn't that be correct? Because the court would be, or DMAS would be aware of the Culpepper argument.
So the initial appellant position during the administrative appeal and during the petition to the circuit court and its opening brief was that in this court in First Stop applied principles of material breach to the provider participation agreement. The First Stop court stated we need not decide here whether as a categorical matter whether ordinary principles of substantial compliance apply. They stated we assume without deciding that they do. Now the appellant's position was misquoted that quotation I just stated
that
to you.
It did include the assuming without deciding part in the
That's
brief.
Correct. And so the court's omission of an issue, and this is what the Morrison Comprehensive Court stated, and this is what the I think the panel had raised about the interpanel doctrine, the Morrison Comprehensive Court stated that omission of an issue is not the same as a decision of the issue. And so I think what this really was the appellant misinterpreting now at this stage that an omission of an issue is a ruling on the issue. And so the arguments that the appellant has presented to this court now are different than the ones that were presented all the way through to the circuit court itself. Their argument was simply that prior to Culpepper, ordinary principles of material breach apply to the provider participation agreement, and that simply is not so. In the Culpepper case, in clear and unequivocal language, this court stated that ordinary principles of substantial compliance were displaced by the terms of the agreement. The terms that were at issue in Culpepper are the same terms that are at issue here today. So accordingly, it should follow that this court should uphold the circuit court's finding and the final agency decision's finding that ordinary principles of substantial compliance were displaced by the terms of the agreement. Now, in all the cases that have come before this court, and I'm including Psychiatric Solutions, First Stop, Culpepper, Ablix, and Morrison Comprehensive, this court has never applied ordinary principles of material breach to the provider's violations. It has never excused, more importantly, a provider's noncompliance with federal and state statutes, regulations, or manual provisions. And I think essentially what this court has done is followed a very simple formula. It's asked, what is the requirement? Did the provider meet that requirement? And if it did not, then in every case that has come before this court has upheld the terms of the agreement and required the provider to refund payment for its failure to comply with the rules and regulations that it's agreed to comply with.
So, counsel, I guess would you concede that if, in fact, the displacement is not before the court, the material breach argument is preserved and before the court, generally?
The argument that material breach applied to the provider participation agreement was preserved. But I think that they had raised two different arguments. One, that it never agreed to comply with it in the first place. And then I believe the second one was a retroactive application, which was never raised up until the reply brief to the circuit court.
Well, let's suppose that, in fact, that the issues, both issues are before the court. In terms of the retroactivity, in terms of the Chevron tests, are any of the elements met?
Your Honor, the Ablex Court actually had addressed that issue itself, and the Ablex Court found that this wasn't a new principle, that clearly overturned a past precedent itself, which is, I think, the first test of the Chevron test. And so the Ablex Court determined that displacement of material breach was not retroactively applied. Even in psychiatric solutions, the court said the same thing that the first stop court had stated, that we need not decide here whether material breach applies. They just assumed without deciding that they do. And so under the Chevron test, it fails that threshold argument that principles of that this is a new standard that overturned a previous standard. And even the Morrison court had recognized that under the interpanel doctrine. Your Honors, this in the subsequent appeal, the Morrison court actually had rejected that argument. The appellant in that case argued that prior to Culpepper, principles of material breach had applied to the provider participation agreement. And the Morrison court clearly rejected that under the interpanel doctrine.
Is there any case that you're aware of that says that the parties cannot, by agreement, include a non-material breach as a violation of the agreement?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The argument seems to be that the parties cannot include in an agreement anything other than a material breach. And I haven't found any case law that says the parties can't by agreement agree that something that is not material would constitute a violation of the agreement.
So our position is that regardless of the violation, regardless of whether it's trivial in some eyes or whether it goes to the heart or root of the contract, a violation is a violation. It's strict compliance.
If the agreement says if you don't put a period at the end of the sentence, you're in violation of the agreement.
That's right.
Would that be a valid and enforceable portion of the agreement?
Absolutely, because by the terms of the agreement, the substantial compliance was displaced. And so, and even, I don't understand how the department would even be able to apply a material standard, because the department is an administrative agency. Mm-hmm. Under the Administrative Process Act, our final agency decisions would be overturned as arbitrary if we did not enforce the plain requirements or the plain language of our requirements. One of the provider's violations was under Error Code 1108, which was a failure to have in its documentation a DMAS 225 form. If the department had excused the provider's violation for not having that form in its documentary evidence, then the next provider can come and argue that it was arbitrary for DMAS to excuse their violations and not their own. And that's simply just not a tenable position for the department to be in. The plain language of its requirements are enforceable by its contract, and so that's what it enforces when it does its audit procedures.
I just have to clarify something. Are you arguing that any failure to meet a requirement that is established for the payments to be made or not retracted would constitute a violation that without going into the issue of whether it's substantial compliance or material breach?
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought I heard you say that. So why are we talking about these other legal principles that you don't think need to be applied?
Because I think that the appellant has raised this argument that material breach applies, that it was the rules were different at some point or another, and our position is that throughout this court's jurisprudence, in every case that has come before this court, the court has always enforced the terms of the agreement, which requires it to refund payment for any violation.
Yeah, so simply put, if we comb through the record as we have, any time we see a violation of something that is in the policy manual, if you will, whatever one has to do to comply with, whether it's the recording of dates or the services or whatever, any time that is not consistent with what policy requires or the law, let's just take policy for the time being, requirements for payment, that's a violation, whether you call it substantial compliance or material breach. You don't even have to get that far.
That's right, what you're arguing.
Yes.
That's as simple as I can put it.
Okay, I just want to be sure. Yeah.
No, any violation that occurs, DMS has the ability to retract payment.
So do we have to discuss the legal issues that have taken up a good part of the argument today at all to get to a resolution in this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think at the end of the day, if you just look at the terms of the agreement, and if you look at how this court's previously ruled based on those same exact provisions and terms, I don't think you need to get any farther than that. I think all, because the Culpeper Regional Hospital's court relied on two specific provisions. One of them was to comply with all applicable state and federal law, as well as administrative policies and procedures of DMAS as from time to time amended. The second one was an unambiguous manual provision, which is providers will be required to refund payments made by Medicaid if they are found to have failed to maintain any record or adequate documentation to support their claims. Both of these provisions, verbatim, are in the appellant's provider participation agreement as well. Your Honor, if I may turn to a separate issue, which is, it's not separate, but it was kind of raised before this panel, which is the two arguments that were raised before this court that were not raised in the circuit court appeal and the administrative appeal. One of those arguments was that there was a reasonable basis for the appellant to believe that material breach applied. The second one was that the appellant did not agree to displace material breach. I think I've addressed it, and I don't want to beat a dead horse again, but it would be unreasonable for the appellant to infer that material breach applied when the court has never applied it in the first place. I'd also like to point out to the court that the assertion is without factual support as well. The appellant's own witness testified that she expected a retraction of payment when it failed to comply with DMAS's laws and policies. The appellant's witness clearly indicated during her testimony that if her company failed to meet a requirement, then they expected payment to be retracted. Your Honors, I'll say this again, and these are the cases that have come before this court. It really has been this simple. The courts always ask, what is the requirement? Did the provider meet that requirement? And if the provider failed to meet that requirement, then it's enforced the terms and conditions by requiring the appellant to refund payment. If I may turn the court's attention to a second issue, it has to deal with whether or not the hearing officer has discretion to waive regulations. During the administrative appeal process, the department's regulations require that both the appellant and DMAS file their documentary evidence with the hearing officer within 21 days. The appellant admits that it did not do so. It failed to timely file its documentary evidence.
But the appellant's point is that there's no prejudice to DMAS.
The actual language of the regulation requires that both parties, if they fail to file that documentation, then that documentary evidence would be considered. If we had not filed it, then there would be prejudice to us in the sense that we didn't follow the regulations. But the opportunity was to both. I mean, both parties had the opportunity to do so, and it failed to do so. The plain language of the regulations themselves require non-consideration for the failure to timely file those documents. There is no...
Your position is that it's ministerial, that it has to be done.
It has to be done, Your Honor. And there is no ambiguity, and there is no provision that allows a hearing officer to waive it, irrespective of whether or not there was any prejudice. The third issue, Your Honors, is the appellant's assertion that DMAS's audit findings were not supported by substantial evidence. The appellant cannot meet its burden of proof through conclusory statements and broad citations to the record. The department submitted into evidence thousands of pages of documents that it reviewed during the audit process. They identified thousands of violations that were organized by Medicaid recipient, date of service, procedure code, paid amounts, and error code. The appellant's burden was to rebut each and every one of those audit findings. For example, if the audit found that there was no DMAS 225 form for recipient AA on date of service 1-1-2018, then the appellant would have to point to a page in the documentary evidence that would show that the required form was there. They simply did not do so. They made each of the findings was supported by testimony and review of thousands of pages of documents. DMAS's own witness identified the appellant's documentary evidence as illegible, in poor condition, and missing information. Your Honors, the documentation has been reviewed by at least four different individuals. It's been reviewed by an informal appeal agent, a Supreme Court hearing officer, the director of DMAS, and finally the circuit court judge. In each of those steps, the individual or the entity upheld the department's findings. And so, Your Honors, for the reasons that I have stated here today and for the reasons that we have listed in our brief, we ask that you uphold the final agency decision and the circuit court's decision.
Thank you. Mr. Holloway?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'll try to speak very quickly because I have limited time. A few misstatements from counsel that I want to address. I thought I heard him say that materiality has never really been considered by the court. I think that's clearly incorrect based on Psychiatric Solutions and ABLEX, both of those court decisions.
I apologize. I didn't take a look at ABLEX. It wasn't cited by you. I had a chance to review that since. And ABLEX says, in this case, ABLEX's documentation deficiencies were contrary to the express terms of the provider agreement. The documentation requirements were not unseen by ABLEX. By not complying with the requirements, ABLEX was in material breach of the provider agreement. I don't find that supporting your argument at all. I find it quite to the contrary. It says that if it's in the agreement and if it's not complied with, you are in material breach of the agreement.
Your Honor, my interpretation of that case is the court does embrace material breach. That was a doctrine that it was applying. And our assertion here is there's a legal error because DMAS has retracted without a finding of material breach.
But it says that if you violate the agreement, that constitutes a material breach. And that's what's happened here.
The court is still using the material breach default rule, which DMAS did not use here in its final decision. There was never any finding of material breach here at all. The other point I wanted to address very quickly is counsel was talking about some testimony from my client at the hearing that related to one particular error code, 1100, which is not even part of this appeal. So there's no broad admission that they're allowed to retract no matter what. That was a separate issue. We never contested that there was a noncompliance on that issue, and so that issue has never been part of this appeal, and it shouldn't even be argued here.
Following up on what he's indicated, just in reference to the one-stop case, one-stop says a similar thing, which is when one-stop failed to maintain records as required by the provider agreement, it was in breach of the contract.
Both First Stop and ABLEX were decided after my client signed the participation agreement. And I'm sorry if I keep beating this point, but if there's any, the whole principle here is we agreed to displace. If we ever agreed to displace, it had to happen in the participation agreement that we signed in February of 2011. So what was the state of the law in February of 2011? The only thing out there.
How do you meet the first prong of the Chevron test if we get to and agree with your argument?
Culpepper is an issue of first impression. That's the first time any court came out and said the participation agreement is deemed to affect a displacement of material breach. Never announced until 2015.
But didn't ABLEX reject that argument? The retroactive application, it rejected the argument that it was a retroactive application?
That was a completely different issue, and I'm glad you brought that up. In ABLEX, the issue was that the provider had said, I never knew that I had to use the DMAS 90 form. And the court said, that's not a new issue. In First Stop, we had already told you that you have to use the DMAS 90 form. So that was the retroactivity issue there. ABLEX never looked at the displacement of material breach and whether that issue can be applied retroactively.
Counsel, I'm going to give you another minute. We sort of barraged you with questions during your rebuttal, so go ahead and About 50 more seconds.
Yeah, so getting back to the Chevron test, there's clearly a new issue here, a first impression that came out in 2015. It's highly prejudicial to my client, and it's unjust to apply that retroactively because, again, the whole idea here is a consensual agreement to displace material breach. In February of 2011, Culpepper wasn't even in the universe. There's no way anybody could know about it. Not even DMAS was asserting a displacement in 2009. So in 2011, when both parties signed that participation agreement, we agreed to comply with applicable law. That's a quote from the agreement. Applicable law was Psychiatric Solutions, and Psychiatric Solutions said providers entitled to payment unless there's a material breach. That is the clear-cut principle from Psychiatric Solutions.
Thank you, counsel.
All right, thank you.
We're going to come down.